Hey, thanks for downloading this podcast. It's brought to you by Talking Life Across Australia and 96.5.
G'day, I'm Peter Janetsky and welcome to Talking Life Across Australia. Tonight, we're talking about why politicians and educated people think that Christians are naive, gullible or stupid and don't seem to have a brain to think for themselves. So maybe you've got some thoughts or comments or questions or a story to share, you can give me a call, 1300 85 1314, or you can email questions@talkinglife.com. As usual, I'm giving away an excellent prize pack, and for your chance to win, keep listening. And remember, you can talk to me, cost of local call, anywhere in Australia, 1300 85 13 14. Or if you're listening over the net, you may want to send in an email question, and you can email that to questions@talkinglife.com. This is Talking Life Across Australia, and it's coming to you from 96.5 in Brisbane and throughout Australia on the Vision Radio Network and around the world via the internet at talkinglife.com. Sporting results from the weekend. Let's talk the rugby league, from the National Rugby League in the Queensland Derby. So both my teams who were playing, not the result I wanted, but I'm still happy with it because a Queenslander won. The Cowboys overcome the loss of their playmaker Jonathan Thurston in the first 4 minutes, and they actually really gave the Broncos a good run, and 26-10. But on the ladder, Broncos are still third. Cowboys moved from seventh to sixth. And AFL, my real love, it was great to see at the Gabba last night that the Brisbane Lions overcame a pretty slow start to run out victors at the end. And 10-point victory to them over Hawthorn, much to my father-in-law's sadness, who's a one-eyed, well, he actually says he's only a one-eyed Hawk supporter, one yellow, one brown. And the final score, 11-18-84 to 11-8-74. And if the Lions kick straight, it could have been a big win. And one of my guests tonight is Michael Knight. Michael, tell us about your beloved West Coast Eagles.
Yes, it was a very tough weekend for us. It was a game that, although I tipped my team to win, I didn't think they really would. But it was one of those heart tips. But no, we went down by 37 points to Collingwood, who deserved the win. They made the best of all of our mistakes. And I was appreciative of Mickey Malthouse, their coach, who said that it was not really a very good win. And he was very displeased with their level of play. It was actually not a great showpiece of a game.
And of course, the talking town in Brisbane is the big Jason Ackermanis and the Brisbane Lions. And latest news is that he's been released from all responsibilities at the moment. So who knows where that's going to go?
Yes, well, that's probably not a bad thing for Brisbane. You take that game last night. I mean, who's winning it for Brisbane at the moment is all their young players, their up and coming players. And you know, that's what every team wants to see. You want to see young people putting in those really hard yards. And Brisbane are in a good situation. I think it'll go well. I mean, the upside of the Ackermanis deal is, you know, it opens up their salary cap a lot.
And the big question is, who can beat the Crows? And at this stage, nobody, I think.
Well, no, I disagree. I think, you know, I mean, they're playing well, really well. I saw a great interview with Grant Thomas after the St Kilda win, and he made a very good point that at the end of this weekend, Adelaide got 4 points, so did St Kilda, so did Collingwood, so did Brisbane. Bottom line is, on the day, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? So, and the talk of the town, the first draw in the competition, the Battle of the Wooden Spoon, and they get a draw. I think someone was telling me, Peter Hellier on one of the TV programs said, well, you know, neither of them lost this week.
Yes, it's a bizarre one, that one.
Yeah. Tonight on Talking Life, we're talking about why politicians and educated people think that Christians are naive, gullible and stupid and don't have a mind and don't think things through. So maybe you've got some thoughts or comments or questions or a story to share. Give me a call, 1-300-85-1314, 1-300-85-1314. That's the cost of a local call anywhere in Australia. Or you can email questions@talkinglife.com. My main guest tonight is Dr. John Patrick. Welcome to the program, John.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
And you've been in Australia doing a bit of a speaking thing at the moment. How long have you been here?
Coming up towards a month, but we leave tomorrow.
Leave tomorrow back to Canada?
That's right.
And what will the temperature be like back at home?
Oh, 26, 27. I get the last month of summer.
Oh, so it'll be nice and pleasant over there.
Yeah.
John, tell our listeners a bit about your background.
Well, I grew up in the UK. I was born in Birmingham to a blue-collar family. Happened to get scholarships, went off to university, did medicine, qualified rather young, and in those days you weren't allowed to have a permanent position till you were mature, so-called. that never happened. I went round internal medicine for a bit, then did a PhD in cell physiology because my wife said, you're not seeing the kids. I rather liked them, so that was a reasonable idea. When that was over, she said, you're not going back to internal medicine, are you? And it wasn't actually a question. And we ended up going to Jamaica for 5 years where I studied the pathophysiology of severely malnourished children, 10-pound two-year-olds, mm-hmm. and was privileged to be part of the group that solved that problem. That came to an end. We went briefly back to Britain, where the job I was supposed to have was immediately cancelled by Mrs. Thatcher. So we became refugees and ended up in North America. And our home since then has been Canada, with regular forays to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I have one wife, four children, and 15 grandchildren at this stage.
15 grandchildren, that's quite remarkable in today's world.
It is.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
You've got more than a cricket team there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and we were talking before we started the program about cricket, and one of the things you have in common, Michael, is both barracking for England in the
Absolutely.
Cricket.
Absolutely.
John, you held the position of Associate Professor at Ottawa University, or University of Ottawa, I think is the correct title. Can you tell us about that position that you held?
I was cross-appointed between biochemistry and paediatrics, primarily based in biochemistry, doing research in how cells function, giving a few lectures when I was forced to, and seeing about 20 patients a week. So it was really a delightful life. The only thing that ruined it was the students. You know.
Sounds like a researcher, you know, having to do lectures when I'm forced to. I like lecturing. I hate preparation and marking. I think that's
I didn't
the
bother
worst
with that.
I don't have the luxuries of a tutor's doing that for me. You finished, I think, at in your role at University of Ottawa, I think, if by memory, about 2002?
Yeah, something like that. It was a gradual changeover, much to my own surprise. A few years ago, the students dragged me out of my ivory tower and I started talking about other things that I hadn't talked about for a long while. I was an invisible Christian for a long while. If I'd been hauled up on a charge of being a Christian, there wouldn't have been enough evidence to convict. But the students picked it up and got on my case, and I ended up initially doing some Bible studies with them, and then they said you should be speaking at conferences, and one thing led to another, and now I spend my life basically talking about religion, faith, public policy and ethics and how they fit together.
And if I remember from your webpage, I think Augusta College, is that?
Augustine or Augustine, whichever you want to say. Yes, I'm president of that at the moment. About six of us, some 10 years ago, became more and more discontented with the state of the state university, which should really be called a multiversity because it has no agreement about the nature of truth. And we realized that Christian students only had about a 20% probability of completing a university course and having an integrated faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought about what the appropriate response would be, and we ended up developing an eight-month course which teaches the history of ideas. It's quite clear that a Bible school doesn't meet the need. The reason being that the university will not accept Scripture as an appropriate starting point, mm-hmm. so one has to start elsewhere. And we teach the history of science, medicine, and mathematics, art and architecture, philosophy and literature, history of music, the history of the church and theology, and Latin to make you a bit more logical. And it's an integrated course, so the kids write 30 essays during the 8 months, and the final exam is oral on all subjects integrated, so you can't memorize and dump, which is the usual substitute for education.
Which is not learning.
Not at all.
No, it's about jumping through hoops, isn't it?
That's right.
We're talking about why politicians and educated people think that Christians often are naive and gullible and don't think. And maybe you got some questions or comments or a story to share. 1-300-85-1314. Cost of local call anywhere in Australia. 1-300-85-1314. And emails at questions@talkinglife.com. It's interesting your comment about, I guess, that tension of universities or government universities not embracing truth.
That's right. Basically, they're in denial of their own history, and they teach tacitly a position they couldn't defend openly.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the history. Universities are ours, not theirs. Their history, as we understand them, as they've developed into our universities, goes back to around the 12th century, 13th century. And they came out directly out of the monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
They were not secular ideas at all. They were Christian ideas. And it's only been in the last 200 or 300 years that we've lost our way, and I think a good many people are recognising that last 200, 300 years of certainly arts faculty history is not good news.
Mm.
So that's one end of the spectrum. And of course, the thing that they teach tacitly is that there's no objective moral truth. Although you only have to see an academic who's been passed over for tenure to see someone demanding justice. Incoherence is their main game.
Yeah. The reason I asked Michael to be part of this is because one of our topics that we like to talk about is this whole area of critical thinking and truth. And Michael, I know that whole thing about multiple realities or there's no objective truth. I think your comment about doing maths exams.
Yeah, no, I thought you asked me here because I was good looking and that I brightened up the studio based on the level of this conversation. But, yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, you know, it always intrigues me that, you know, people want to argue for that pluralistic position and simultaneously will then tell you that 1 + 1 equals 2. And that if you come along and say, well, actually, I want 1 + 1 to equal oranges, they go, well, that's insane and you're absurd. Well, by what definition? And there's, you know, I mean, I'm dealing within the realm of a high school level, you know,
yes.
13 to 17 year olds. When you talk to the teachers at large about this, it always intrigues me the inconsistency of what goes on. And my argument a lot of time is I'm just arguing for a level playing field or some consistency here, please.
It seems to me that the thing that's got mixed up most is something that C.S. Lewis pointed out a long while ago, that most heresy is not something that's intrinsically bad, but a good thing in the wrong place. And I think if you talk to students in the university anyway, their desire for moral relativism is more directed towards things like tolerance, which seem to them to be so important, until you say, well, what about child abuse? Do you tolerate that? And then they start thinking that they've been hoodwinked into accepting an organization of behavior that's illogical.
I think the other one is, do we believe in a democratic society, are we going to believe in that the strongest one gets to rule?
Yeah.
That goes back a long way, all the way to Socrates, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Always intrigues me too in that whole notion that I always like to challenge, that I think in the area of evolution, it isn't, you know, the strongest, the survival of the fittest, it's the destruction of the weakest.
Yes. Well, yeah. Would you say there's a real difference between those two?
No.
But
what I'm intrigued by is the blind, the ignoring of one.
Yes.
Over the claiming of the other.
Yes.
Yeah. And if we're going to take that whole thing about, you know, the survival of the fittest, then maybe we shouldn't intervene in schoolyard bullying.
Yeah.
Oh, we have so many accepts.
Yeah.
That's the way we do it. We rationalize our own desires. But again, it's interesting. It always seems to me it's often poets who see what is going to happen before anyone else. Just a couple of months ago at Harvard, I was talking about abortion, and I suddenly realized that there was one of Harvard's favorite sons who had made the point that I wished to make much better than I could, and that was Robert Frost. And I was talking about the connection, actually, between abortion rights and animal rights. And Frost saw it coming a long while ago in a poem called The Whitetail Horn. It's amazing how these things happen. It popped into my mind, and so did all the words, and that's just gift, isn't it? It was really nothing to do with me, but Frost, like I do, lived on a farm, and he had some hornets take up abode in his barn one year, and he was fascinated by them. He went too close once and got stung, but he learned where he could go, and he watched them with interest. And one day, as he was watching these hornets, one of them attacked the remains of a nail in the woodwork, and it took 3 goes to find out this wasn't food, not a very smart hornet. And then he realized that there was something interesting here, and he wrote this poem, The Whitetail Hornet, and the lines that came to mind go like this. Won't this instinct matter bear revision? Won't almost any theory bear revision? To err is human, not to animal. Or so we pay the compliment to instinct that really takes away instead of gives. Our humour, conscientiousness and worship went long since to the dogs under the table and served us right for having instituted downward comparisons. As long on earth as our comparisons were stoutly upwards, with gods and angels we were men at least. But once our comparisons were yielded downwards into the mud and even dust, 'twas disillusion upon disillusion.
Mm.
We were lost piecemeal to the animals, like people thrown out to delay the wolves. Only our fallibility was left us, and this day's work makes even that seem doubtful. Now, what Frost had understood, of course, is if Darwin was right, and if the general tenor of our society was right, then all the things we cherish most are illusions,
mm.
and we will end up as animals governed by our reflexes, our instincts.
Mm.
And meaning disappears in that process.
I think that's a really important common meaning. Mm. Talking Life Across Australia, we're talking about, I guess, being intelligent, critical thinkers as Christians and challenging the opinions of others who think that we're naive. 1-300-85-1314. Cost of local call anywhere in Australia. 1-300-85-1314. Or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. John, as you talk, you know, I do a lot of work in the area of sexuality. And when I talk to young people, I say one of the greatest insults that I think is given to young people is that you're just a bunch of hormonal animals.
Mm.
And I say to them, I say, one, is that actually defies your capacity to be actually thinking.
Yes.
And then secondly, is that people who say that really don't understand the difference between animal sexuality and human sexuality,
mm.
which is about being meaning.
Yes.
And it's not controlled by urges, as some would have us portray. And in fact, it is that thing. It's actually quite derogatory, and it goes to, I guess, the lowest common denominator, not the highest common denominator.
One of the talks I get asked to repeat again and again and again is, I think, one of the most powerful ways of doing pre-evangelism that I know. But it begins, it's called The Four Levels of Happiness. And you can get it off my website if you want. But I say to students, do you want to be happy? And, of course, everyone does. And I say, well, do you know that happiness is a layered thing? No. Are you interested? Of course. So I have permission and away I go. And I say, well, happiness one I call animal happiness. That's the happinesses we share with the animals, basically food and sex. And we're ruining both of them. Animals can't ruin it. There's no feeding disorders in animals. and there's no sexual disorder in animals, really, to speak of. But with us, it's quite different. We, of course, were meant to feed socially, where we learned good manners and good conversation. Instead, we watch the box now, and we've lost good manners and we've lost good conversation as a result. And I spend a lot of time as a pediatrician talking particularly to young women who are starving themselves or vomiting. That's unhappiness one, which is what happens when you abuse the goods that God gives us. Now, sexuality is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm about to say is profoundly countercultural. And the first time I did it, I was frightened, but I'm not anymore, because I've never had anyone deny this, except once in a Christian college where the professor of biology was having an affair, tried to deny it. He didn't last long. But the first time I said it, I was talking to a student on an aeroplane, because you always try outrageous ideas out on aeroplanes. You're never going to meet the guy next to you again. So
Michael tries them out on me.
So I said to him, if you're like my class, you're sleeping around. The trouble with that is if you sleep around, sex will shortly become first boring and then perverted.
Mm.
And I waited for him to say, that's not true. But he didn't. And no one ever has. Because it is true. We all know now that the people who have the best sex were chaste before marriage and faithful afterwards. Nobody else comes close. That's not very many of us these days. But nevertheless, the data is there. He, of course, had had several girlfriends in the previous year, and each relationship was shorter than the one before. That's why they boast about one-night stands. They've got nothing else to boast about.
Mm.
They're having animal sex. And, of course, in the homosexual community, they probably have more anonymous sex than any other group. That's real animal sex. That's like my cows on the farm. It's just about an animal instinct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's unhappiness too, as well. And the only way out is to go to happiness. Sorry, that's unhappiness one as well. The only way out is to go to happiness two. I call happiness two finding out what you're good for. It could be athletic skills or intellectual skills. Obviously, I'm interested in the latter. It's what Socrates wanted the university to be, a place where you grow your mind to something that's worthy of a human being.
Mm.
But I can talk to modern students about what's your learning style, and I get deadpan faces, you know, learning style, what on earth are you talking about? I say, well, is your experience of the university in the previous few years been one that you're proud of? Has it enabled you to build an understanding of what it means to be human that's deeply satisfying? Do you get up in the morning and say, good, another day at university? And I have them laughing in the aisles, because what they actually do is memorize and dump. Mm. They couldn't even pass the exam they passed 6 weeks ago, because they never learned it. They only memorized it briefly. That's deeply unsatisfying. And of course, with continuous evaluation added to it, you have a perfect recipe for neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 20% of our students in the medical school abusing drugs and alcohol in no time, because that's the only way they can deal with their anxieties.
Wasn't it Carl Jung who said unhappiness is the central neurosis of our time?
Of course, and it is, isn't it?
Mm.
Then the only way out then is to go up another notch, and most people don't know anything about levels 3 and 4. Level 3 is when you realize that some things are intrinsically worthwhile. They're worth doing in and of themselves. The best example that most people still know, but diminishingly so, is parenting.
Mm.
Nobody can pretend that bringing up 2-year-olds is pure continuous joy. But if you're allowed to win and do a good job and they grow up and you're proud of them, there's nothing in your life that matters as much as your kids.
Mm.
That's wonderful. When you get to grandchildren, it's even better. But lots of people don't know about that. Medicine, which was my trade, is an activity where you can do things beyond the call of duty. And every now and again you get sucked into the care of a patient beyond the call of duty. You don't get paid more for it in dollars, but you never forget those patients if you're allowed to win against the odds. Mm. It's a wonderful experience. The best happiness 3 that I ever did in my life was taking medical students with me to Africa. And I would spend an afternoon, these are preclinical students, training them how to resuscitate a malnourished child, and then walk with them for a day or two into the bush, into a village that I'd chosen for them, that I wanted surveyed. And they had to do a health survey, find 2 malnourished children and resuscitate them, and weigh and measure all the under fives. And of course, I'd put them to live in the village with a family that I knew was a good family, a Christian family. Now, I didn't take Christian students particularly because I wanted idealists. And many Christians, when they arrive at university, are in revolt against their background.
Mm-hmm.
It's better for them to get over that before you have anything to do with them. But these kids were transformed by the experience of living without any running water, without any electricity, in a mud hut. They realized there were lots of things the Africans had that they'd lost.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a marvelous experience. But happiness 3 is a need to be needed love. You've got to be able to give something to the other person. And of course, it comes to an end. Emptiness syndrome, retirement, chronic disease. You get to unhappiness 3. The only way out now is to go to happiness 4. And I love doing this in a secular setting because, say, a place like New York is perfect. All these wonderful atheistic Jewish physicians are absolutely obsessive compulsive. And at this point, I say, but I can't possibly tell you what happiness 4 is in a state-funded institution. And they nearly go nuts. You know, they won't sleep tonight if I don't fill in the blanks. I play the game for up to 5 minutes. And then I say, well, I'll take the risk if I've got a quorum. And up go 90% of the hands. Now, all I have to do now, because they're very smart, you say, well, look, let me just tell you a few happiness 4 stories. You'll recognize them. And then you have to ask yourself, does my way of understanding the world have a space for this stuff? And I always begin with the same story because I want them to get the book. It's not mine. It's a colleague from Yale, a woman called Diane Comp, who ran the pediatric oncology program there for many years. She's retired now, and as a retirement project, she's gone to Liberia to work with the kids who had their arms chopped off and things in the war. But like me, she grew up in a Christian home, went to university, lost her faith, usual process. I didn't lose mine seriously. I flirted with Marxism and was basically ambitious. You get over both of those. But she became an existentialist, which is a serious problem, and a serious existentialist. So she believed that life had no meaning. Mm. Don't worry about that. Just live a good life now, because that's the best way to live. So she did everything for the kids. She ran support groups. Parents going to lose their kids. You name it, she did it. But she didn't know what to say to dying kids. The only honest thing to say would be, I'm sorry you're dying, I'm glad it's not me. But that's not kind, and she was a kind lady, so she solved the problem by not being there. But a mother would turn up at the back of her head and say, Diane, I didn't bring you up to desert children you love and who love you when they need you. In the end, she gave in. Unfortunately, God, being the God he is, showed up with the first child. I don't put that in New York, of course. I let them put that in. Hospital chaplain, Diane, and parents sitting by the bed, a little girl of 8, semi-conscious, dying of leukemia. But just before she died, she sat up in bed and said, "Mummy, can you see the angels? Can you hear their singing? It's beautiful." And she fell back dead. Now, the hospital chaplain actually ran away. He'd only got psychology 101, and they hadn't covered this. The parents turned out to be Christian, and it was a huge help in their bereavement. And the little professor didn't give in, but she was honest. She knew that she had seen something for which she had no explanation, and it was important. What she'd actually seen was the promise of our Lord, that he that believeth in me shall never die. We don't die. The only people who see death are the people left behind. You and I are not going to see it. It's not the way it works, and the children show you that. Now, it took 2 more children to bring her back to faith. She said, "I was an arrogant Yale professor, so in the end God used a child with an IQ of 80 to bring me back to faith." That's a happinessful story. I could keep you here for the next 3 hours talking about happinessful stories. The eruption into our time and place of something that's bigger than us.
This is Talking Life Across Australia. My guest is Dr. John Patrick. And John has been a professor and travels the world lecturing on a whole heap of issues. And we're talking about, you know, probably really critical Christian thinking. And maybe you got a question, 1-300-85-1314, 1-300-85-1314. We can email questions at talkinglife.com. John, can we go back to the history of universities for a moment?
Sure.
We moved away from that because I think it's really, really important that if I look at Western civilization, it's like we have this great divide where we've moved away, where we've handed over like secular universities or government universities to the masses, and then we're withdrawing Christians out and we'll put them in Christian universities and never the twain shall meet. And yet my understanding historically is that, as you said, this has only been the last few hundred years, but when I've looked a little bit at history, and I'm not an expert on it, but the primary seat of learning or the major school in early university was the theological school.
It was the only one. Everything came out of that. Everybody who did any of the teaching in university was a Catholic priest. Mm-hmm. That's the way it was. The history is really a very interesting one, and if it was better known, some of the hubris of the liberals would diminish a bit. They only keep the position going by keeping us in ignorance. The story can be told in many different ways, but I think one way that's easy to remember and will bring many of the points together but can be denied at one level, but not an important level, is that the key changes really occurred in the 13th century. Universities had been going 100 years or so, and Thomas Aquinas and others had reintroduced Aristotle to the Western world, where it had come in through Spain, having been preserved by the Muslims. I mean, that amazing story, Greeks to Nestorian Christians and Jews to the libraries and all the rest in the Islamic world. And the Islamic world doesn't realize that the libraries were actually run by Jews and Nestorians. Their scholars do, but ordinary Muslims don't. It was preserved and it came across North Africa and into Spain. Then, after the long so-called Dark Ages, which were not so dark, Christians were ready to learn again, and they realized there was intellectual wealth in Spain, and they started crossing the Pyrenees and bringing it back. Now, in the 11th and 12th centuries, the Islamic world was ahead of the Christian world, but since the next 8 centuries, it's been straight ahead for the Judeo-Christian world and dead stop or backwards for the Islamic world, and they've got to come to terms with that. Anyway, Aristotle blew the minds of the Western world, and Thomas then spent his lifetime integrating Christian thought with Aristotle's thought in very profound ways, which totally influenced our world. But there were some people in the Catholic Church at that time who were worried about this and worried whether Aristotle might not spoil the faith, especially for the humble poor. And in 1277, Aristotle's teaching was banned in the University of Paris, the deductive logic of Aristotle. Now, nobody knows exactly what happened, but I like to imagine that the prof, so to speak, went for a beer and said, "What on earth are we going to do? We can't use our notes for next year." You imagine your professors at the university suddenly being told to start from scratch next academic year. They would not be pleased people. And Aristotle knew about deductive reasoning, reasoning from the big to the particular. It had never got as far as he wanted it to. It hadn't given us any control over nature to speak of. He also knew about inductive reasoning, arguing from the particular to the big, but he never trusted it because he believed the world tended to its rightful place. And you could only really study pathology by doing experiments. In other words, and this is a big problem, for almost all societies, experiments were unbelievable because inductive reasoning was unbelievable. If you believe in evil spirits, you'll never do an experiment because they're local. Experiment done in Brisbane, one done in London, different answers, different evil spirits. And so you can imagine these Christian professors sitting down over a beer and saying, you know, well, we could teach inductive reasoning. And if God is who we believe he is, under the surface chaos of life, there must be laws. Maybe we can discover them. And that's how science began. It didn't begin with the Renaissance. It began long before that. It began with Christian people in places like Merton College, Oxford. And, of course, it reached its height with Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton. Four men who totally changed our understanding of the cosmos, all of whom believed in God, the Christian God. The Galileo story needs rewriting for most people because they think, you know, he was basically flayed at the stake by the Inquisition. Not true at all. It was actually a spat between physicists who were all Christian. There weren't any others. And Galileo was obviously a very arrogant young man, and he sort of trashed another Jesuit physicist in his youth in public, and the guy never forgot. And then Aristotle, and then Galileo overstepped the limit later on, and this Jesuit set the ball rolling for heresy, and once it was rolling, it was difficult to stop it until Galileo had been forced to recant. It was the beginning of a big change.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes as a great shock to my students when I tell them, well, take Kepler as an example. He wrote prayers in his lab book. Newton's comment after he'd finished his work was, this cosmos could only proceed from a divine mind.
Mm.
Galileo, all his life, was a devout Catholic, despite being forced to repent. I mean, his penance is one that you and I would pay for. I mean, being forced to live on your farm outside Florence, I mean, that really is a penance, isn't it? There's a few of us who could handle that one. But that's what happened. And then the really interesting thing is that, of course, the church did mishandle this whole affair, so they lost credibility. Very shortly, inductive reasoning gave us first a model of the cosmos that worked, and then a lot of other things. So science grew in credibility and the church diminished. And within 100 years or so of the death of Newton, you have Laplace saying to Napoleon when asked, where does God fit into your science? Laplace, a practicing Catholic, said, I don't need the hypothesis of God. And you get that from every high school physics master now. Well, it's true he doesn't need the hypothesis of God to use inductive reasoning, to use experiment, once it had been shown to work. But without the idea of God in the first place, it would never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
As Butterfield from Cambridge puts it, if Newton had not had his God, he would not have gone looking for his laws.
Mm.
Be honest. And we're a dishonest world. Before we finish this little section, let me just give you an example of what I mean. My favorite one at the moment is to say, let me tell you the story of a man whose name any educated person knows. But I'll tell you that story in a slightly different way. And you raise your hand when you know who it is. And the story goes like this. His father was a blacksmith in London. He had what education he had in the church, where he went every week. By the time he was 11 or 12, he was binding books in London as an apprentice. Basically, the Encyclopedia Britannica, which he read. Especially the science bits, which fascinated him. Then he started going to the Royal Society public demonstrations of experiments, took excellent notes. By the time he was in his mid-teens, he was saying to himself, I don't want to be a bookbinder. I want to be the lab tech at the Royal Society who sets experiments up. So he bound his notes and he sent them off to the president of the Royal Society. He was duly impressed and sent for him, and he got the job. It wasn't long before the president wouldn't travel without this young man, because not only did he do what he was told, he thought about the experiments and extended them in very creative ways. And scientists all over Europe realised he was a very bright young man. Eventually, he became president of the Royal Society himself with no formal education other than what he'd got in the church. And he was known to stop the meetings of the Royal Society in order to get to his prayer meeting. People came from all over Europe to find out what made him tick and found out by listening to him preach, which he did most weekends. Now, do you know his name? You do, but could you tell it to me? Obviously not. Any of you in the studio? None of you. It's Michael Faraday, who basically did electricity on his own. Now, if the unit on electricity in Australian schools began with that story, which would be a legitimate thing to do, would that make any difference to the reflex anti-Christian rhetoric that they're normally forced to deal with? It would, wouldn't it? And if you make a list of the world's most famous scientists without any chronological snobbery, you'd be amazed at how many of them are deeply Christian.
Mm.
In this little story alone, you've got Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and then you come on through Boyle to Faraday to Clerk Maxwell to Eddington. I mean, it's a pretty impressive group.
John, as you roll off those names, it's very challenging to the whole topic tonight of why our general society, our politicians, our academics think that Christians are gullible and naive or even stupid when we actually look at our history. And when we turn a blind eye to that history, we'll probably pay a price for that. Coming up to the break, we're going to be taking your calls, and you can call me on 1300 85 1314. My guest is Dr. John Patrick, a professor who has worked in academic positions right around in a number of places in Canada and Britain and
Jamaica
Africa, and lectures around the world about Christian ethics and Christian thinking. So maybe you've got a question or comment, 1300 85 1314, 1300 85 1314, or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. You're listening to Talking Life across Australia, coming to you from 96.5 in Brisbane and throughout Australia on the Vision Radio Network and around the world via the internet at talkinglife.com.
Don't go away, this program continues on Track B.